Welcome to Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life. Each month, Galley Table Storytelling hosts a live event in the Kodiak community. Storytellers are given 7 minutes to tell a personal story related to a monthly theme. Tonight, we're going to hear those stories.
Join me in welcoming our first storyteller to the stage. Gretchen Powers was born in Vermont, raised in Colorado, lived in Maine, and moved to Kodiak a little over a year ago with her wife, Kaylee, and her pup, Ella, a purebred harbor seal. While her wife is off driving buoy tenders for the Coast Guard, Gretchen spends her time as a full-time photographer and filmmaker. When she doesn't have a camera in her hands, you can find her knitting, hiking, or doing both at the same time. Please welcome Gretchen.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Galley Tables. I'm going to start off this evening by giving you a little Nepali lesson. When I went to Nepal about 7 years ago, I was told that there was one phrase that I was going to need to know to survive my time in country, and that was, Ke Garne. Now, Ke Garne literally translates to what to do, but more so means what can you do. Now, I was standing on the side of one of the world's most dangerous roads close to the end of my time there. I had my backpack full of camera gear. I was sweating. I was like, I don't even know what I'm doing right now. But I remembered Ke Garne. So I boarded this bus, and I was like, okay, this is a little scary because there's this massive cliff to one side of like this whole river valley. And I'm like, okay, we got this, Gretchen. This is going to be fine. So I board the bus, I sit down, and I prepare myself for about 18 hours of chaos, because that's kind of what you run into a lot in Nepal, is absolute chaos. But I survived that day because of Ke Garne. So I shared a seat with a pig, two goats, and four chickens at one point. Ke Garne. I had a woman hand me her baby, and I don't even really like kids, but I held this infant for about an hour. Ke Garne. And we got on and off the bus a multitude of times because of rock slides so that everyone would get off. I don't know how they managed to get the bus up and over the rock slide, but they would, and then we'd get back onto the bus. The best part of the day for me was when we got to this junction. We had to get off of our bus and onto another bus to get onto another place. There were a lot of bus rides this day. And I'm looking around, and there isn't much signage. And at this point, my Nepali language skills are pretty good because we've been having 2 hours of class every day for the last 3 months. But there's no signs anywhere, and I was more confused than I was last fall when I visited my sister in New York City and trying to get around on the subway system. So, in the last 7 years since then, there have been a multitude of road trip opportunities with my now wife where we've had to use the expression Ke Garne. And none of them stands out to us quite like Canadian Thanksgiving of 2016. Now, we are in Quebec, which, for those of you who haven't been, not a lot of people speak English there. It's very French. And as much as like I've taken 4 years of French class in high school, that wasn't very helpful. But we'd had a great weekend, and we were leaving, pulling out of the hotel parking lot, and we hear that, you know, the ominous like thunk out of the bottom of the car, and we're like, oh God, like what just fell out? I look back to make sure my sister's still in the car, because I was a little worried at that point. So we pull over, we get out, and naturally it was her fault too. You know, there's that moment where everyone's yelling at each other, and somehow it's like, you know, everyone else's fault. But remember, Ke Garne. What are you going to do? Well, in this case, my knitting addiction and or, you know, it's an addiction, I'll admit it. But anyway, it came in handy because we found that the front half of our drive shaft was on the ground. The back half was still attached to the car with about 15 years of New England rust. But we didn't really know what to do about the front half. So, but I had some very thick yarn. I wasn't exactly sure what weight it was graded to, but I used my superior knitting skills to rig the front half of the drive shaft back up into the car. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, but we still had this problem of we have to drive 7 hours back home to New England through rural Canada on Canadian Thanksgiving. This isn't really going to work. So we got ourselves a brunch, you know, the like hangover brunch after the wedding. It's like obligatory, but everyone's still half asleep. Well, we got ourselves there and we talked to my uncle because he was the only person who spoke French. And we're like, Uncle Michael, what do we do? And he's like, it's okay. He was on the same board with this whole Ke Garne plan. So we're going to make the most of the day is what we did. I never get to see this part of my family. You know, they live in Canada. and so I was like, this is a bonus round, you know? What I didn't know was that we were going to spend the next 4 hours driving around this small hamlet with my uncle using my photography skills as attempted collateral for people to, one after the other, get under the car and attempt to remove the back half of this drive shaft. Okay, remember that 15 years of New England rust? It wasn't going anywhere. But we lucked out because we were driving through town, we drive by his mechanic shop, And the mechanic happens to be there working on his own car. And so we go in, and I use those 4 years of high school French, and I say, bonjour, merci. And my wife's standing next to me, we're both smiling, just trying to look cute, and like, please help us. And he took pity, he with 2 seconds, you know, with one of those mechanical things, I don't know what it is, but took it off, no problem, wrapped it up in a tarp, throw it back in the car, and he walks up to me and hands me the yarn, asking if I'd like to keep it for my memories. Now, I'm telling you this story because life in Alaska is unpredictable at best, at times. And I feel like, you know, remembering Kay Garnet is what it takes to get through a really awesome day, to make the most of the situation you're in. So the next time Safeway has no produce, or your Amazon Prime shipment takes 4 weeks instead of 4 days to get here, or the trusty testy gets canceled for another month, just remember, Kay Garnet. It might just make your day.
Our next storyteller is Rachel Neumer. And in exciting news, Rachel just turned 50 years old. And she insisted on having all the candles on her birthday cake. She says she always does this and she always will. Please welcome Rachel.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rachel. And a lot of you probably know my son, Gabriel, who just graduated from high school last year. And he went off and joined the Air Force. And he is in training right now to become a pararescueman, which is one of those things that's not very easy to do. So he's really lucky that he actually got accepted into the program. Yes. And he left home. It was the end of October. And he hadn't hugged me in a long time, but the day he left, he gave me a hug, he put his arms around me, and he sighed, and he said, "This is it, Mom." And I said, "I know, Gabe. It's going to be okay. It's a beautiful day to leave home." And it really was. It was one of the most beautiful days I'd seen in Kodiak in a very long time. And I didn't feel bad. I felt really good for him. I was happy for him. He was doing what he wanted to do. So, at any rate, I just wanted to ask everybody in the audience, can you guys keep a secret? No? I'm going to tell you anyway. Well, and I can't leave this room, okay? About a year ago, my husband of 21 years ran away with another woman. And then he got remarried about a year ago. Well, it's kind of hard to talk about this, but it is a part of the story. So, and I'm just kidding because I know a lot of people know about it. So it is a small town. Anyway, so the reason I'm telling you this is because it is a part of the story. It is important. And if anybody out here has ever been through a divorce, it can be devastating. And I think it's been devastating for me and my children, but we've you know, picked ourselves up by our bootstraps and carried on. So thank you. And one of the things that, you know, I always remind myself of in the darkest of times, and I've had quite a few of those times, is that God is truly amazing and that he loves me. And I don't just think this, I know this. And I'm sure there's people out in the audience who know that themselves. And I hope that for everyone, that you will all know that God loves you and that God is truly amazing. Yes. So anyway, Gabriel called me from boot camp on Thanksgiving. I was so excited to hear from him. And he said that he'd be graduating at the beginning of January 3rd. So his graduation ceremony lasted for 3 days, and it was in San Antonio, Texas. So we had to find a way down there. And like I said, I just got divorced, and let me tell you something, divorce is very expensive. So, but I love my son so much. And to think about not being there for him was too much for me, no matter what it cost. So one of the things my husband did not like about me was that I'm a bargain shopper. So I was bargain shopping for airline tickets. And because, everybody in this room can relate, especially if you have a family. It costs about $10,000 to go anywhere. You probably could have remodeled your bathroom, So anyway, so I started looking, and a really nice lady told me one of the best things that you could do was just buy a piece at a time. Just buy a one-way ticket here and a one-way ticket there. And I was doing really good. I was doing great. I got the ticket from Anchorage to Phoenix. Oh, and by the way, we were going to stop in Phoenix because my middle son, Joshua, got a scholarship to Arizona State University. So we wanted to stop there, and then we were going to go... we were making that our base, basically. So I got everything, but one part of it I could not find an affordable ticket for. Oh, gosh, I got a lot more to tell you guys, but anyway, it's probably not going to happen. So I couldn't find an affordable ticket, so I decided I'd have to drive. I talked to people about this. I was going to drive from Phoenix to San Antonio and then back, and I was trying all these different things to try to make it work. Everything lined up for me to take this road trip. So anyway, we got off the airplane in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was snowing. And I talked to somebody about that, and they said that it only snows there every 80 years. So at any rate, so I started driving, and then, of course, I had my 17-year-old in the back and my other son in the minivan. And so anyway, and one of the things people told me is that it's a very easy road to drive. It's flat and straight. However, there are a lot of 18-wheelers. It's a major trucking route. And so I was like, oh, I think I can handle this. How bad could it be? I might have to save the rest of the story. But so anyway, I drove all the way to El Paso, and I wasn't going to stay in El Paso because it didn't look like a very easy town to get along in. So I decided beforehand, I had decided that I was going to stay in a place called Van Horn, Texas. It's about 150 miles south of, that's it, isn't it? Do you guys want to hear any more? Okay. All right. Okay. So I'll try to be efficient about it, because I do have to go back to work. My boss is right there, and he knows it. So right there, Jim Willis, right there. You can raise your hand. So anyway, this is it's kind of important that I finish the story. So I'll try to be fast, and I have to be back by 8 o'clock. So, okay. So at any rate, we're driving along, and there's lots of big rigs. Now, some of you have probably driven roads like this before. Has anybody ever driven I-10? Show of hands. So you know what I'm talking about. There's lots of semis on the road. And I'm a little lady, and I'm not that strong. And these cars would come, the trucks would come along. They'd come along from behind. They'd go, and they go like this. And as they're going like that, you're kind of going like this in your car. And then they pull you back in because there's kind of like a vacuum there. And so here I am like this every time. Here it comes another one. They can tell you. They were there. There's probably about 100 of them I had to go near. And I realized what that was. You'll never guess that you would never imagine that Lamaze breathing would come in handy. I was like, oh my God, that was what that was. I wouldn't have survived. And then I talked to one of my coworkers. And he does not like to drive highways. He says, I don't do it. And I'm surprised because he's a retired coastie. He did like 27 years. I think, the guy's probably very capable. And I said, he goes, oh, you know what it's like when they come by and you're like this? And I was like, oh, yeah. But I thought that was just me. He says, oh, no, everybody does that when they pass. So, see, guys, I'm not abnormal. So anyway, we stopped at Whataburger, which is in El Paso. That's a good place. Yeah, and then we got on the road, and I didn't realize it, but it was rush hour, and it was dark, and it was El Paso. And so I was driving along, and I was doing okay. You know, it was a little scary for me. So then a big rig out of nowhere. It seemed like out of nowhere. It went like this, and then it went, and then this car went here, went like this, and then another one like that. And I was like, oh my God, we almost got into a multi-car accident. And so I didn't feel so good at that point, but I just kept driving, and we made it through, but I was like, when is El Paso over? It just kept going and going and going. And so anyway, we got out of there, and I felt so good. I felt relieved. So we kept driving, and it was dark out, and it seemed like it just turned into rush hour traffic for 18-wheelers. And I was like the only passenger car on the road. And I drove probably for about 3 hours more in the dark. And I started out at 6:30 in the morning, and I got there at 10 o'clock at night. And I stayed at a place called the Basic Lodge, which stands for... That's funny, isn't it? let me tell you guys something. If you ever have to drive I-10, you need to stop at the Basic Inn. It is one of the nicest hotels I've ever stayed at, it, and it's very affordable. It's a 1940s building that they renovated, and it's very clean. And it's hard to find a clean hotel these days, I'll tell you that. So anyway, I stayed there, and... Okay, should I stop? Okay. I'll try to wrap this up. I don't want to... So anyway, here we are. Okay. So anyway, we check into the room. I kind of like toss my kids into the room. And then I go to the front desk. This lady, Victoria, I have to tell you, I learned about them online. And I wanted to stay there because the owners of this hotel, Lance and Victoria Southard, have a connection to Kodiak. Lance Southard grew up here part of the time. And his wife is an author. And I really like writing a lot. So I wanted to stay there because I thought it would be neat to talk to her and also to talk to him. And so anyway, I got there and threw the kids in the hotel room, went over to the office and said, oh, by the way, it wasn't really funny at that point. I was just totally drained. And so I just said, I needed to use a computer, so they let me use she let me use her husband's computer, and I sat down. I had to cancel a reservation at another hotel the next day, or they were going to charge me money. And it was like the last thing on my to-do list that I had to do. So anyway, it gets a little sad here, but it's not so bad. I was tired and I was sad, and I had sensory overload because of all these 18-wheelers that were passing me and all of this that I had been doing, and my 17-year-old that was in the back of the car insisting that he was going to drive too. So anyway, but of course I didn't let him. And at any rate, I sat down and I said to Victoria, I said, I just need somebody to talk to because I was just, you know, just totally stripped of all my pretense. I was tired. I had been through so much to get where I was at her hotel in Van Horn, Texas, in the middle of nowhere. And she just looked like she settled herself into her chair and like strapped herself down and looked at me and started talking to me. And I told her what had happened, you know, to my family. And of course, I was crying a lot. And I told her, you know, how expensive it was just to, you know, take this trip. And I told her what happened in El Paso. I said, I almost got into a multi-car accident. And she said, so she told me, oh, don't worry, because they drive like that in El Paso all the time. They don't have any insurance, and they get into accidents, and they just run away. And she said to me, you need to let it go. She said, tomorrow is going to be a new day. And I said, well, I don't think that I can drive another 500 miles. And she said, don't worry about it. You're going to be fine. So she just made me feel better. And it was like 12:30 when I went back to the room. I fell asleep. and I got about 4 hours of sleep, and I left my hotel room at about 6 that morning, and as I was coming out, I was pulling the bags out, and her husband came and met me at the hotel room door, and he started talking to me a little bit about Kodiak and who I knew and who he knows and so on and so forth, and then he handed me a letter, and it had my name on it. And it was a lot puffier than this. It was really puffy. And I said, and he said, he patted my arm. He patted my arm like this. And he said, "This is from Victoria." And I looked down at it and I said, "Oh, Victoria wrote me a letter. Isn't that sweet?" And then I didn't have time to read it, so I just stuffed it in the console of my car. And then I started driving 500 miles. And he told me before I left, he said, "Be careful, you'll be fine, but be careful because black ice forms on the little bridges." So I was like, "Thanks," and I left. And okay, I'll leave you guys now. But at any rate, it wasn't just a letter. Victoria did write me a beautiful letter, and I would read it to you, but I'm out of time. At any rate, I know I have to go, but I'm just going to wrap it up. Dear Rachel, I hope you will take this gift. It is not from me, but God. For nothing is of our own, and everything is given in blessings. Please allow me to bless you and your boys with this money. May you use it to enjoy your trip to see your son. God's timing is not our own. He will answer in his time and in his way. He knows best, and he knows what you need at the exact moment you need it. This road of life we take was never meant to be easy. If it was, we would never learn from ours or others' mistakes. God never makes a mistake. Trust in him fully, and he will bless you. With much love and blessings, Victoria Southard. Sorry. Lastly, there was $1,000 in the letter. And if you want to write a little note to Gabe, I have a poster over there. Thank you.
Lydia Cullum. Lydia has lived in Kodiak almost all of her entire life, but sadly doesn't have the honor and privilege of being born here. When not working in the emergency department as a nurse, she is most likely outdoors seeking some adventure, whether that's kayaking, hiking, or with her two dogs, or trying her hand at photography. While at first glance Lydia may seem quiet, she often makes her friends laugh with her weird quirks, like luring whales to her with dory whale calls. If you know that, you know how fun that is. Her need to spontaneously sing show tunes or her spectacularly comical attempts at cartwheels. She is so thankful that she grew up in Kodiak and has chosen to stay here as an adult, even when so much of her family has moved away. The Coast Guard is what originally brought her family here, and that trip is the topic of her story tonight. Lydia.
Well, am I glad that I did not have to drive at all on this road trip? It sounds really scary. So this road trip is what originally brought my family to Kodiak, and it is a combination of some of my earliest memories and some gaps that were filled in by my dad. So let me set the scene for you. It's 1995, and my dad just got orders that he's going to be working at Air Station Kodiak. He's always wanted to live in Alaska. This is a dream come true. But he knows that there's some preparation that needs to happen before his family is Alaska ready. The first thing that's got to go is our state-of-the-art minivan that had, for the time, like the state-of-the-art, it had TVs in it and everything. Trade that sucker. That can't make it on the Alcan. So my dad trades that in for a huge black diesel four-door Supermax F-250 truck. The man's got the truck for the Alcan. In addition, we weren't made of money. We were a family of six and military to boot, so we couldn't afford hotels the whole way, so we got a camper so that we could camp along the way. The man's got the truck. The man's got the camper. He's almost Alaska ready. So We were a family of six. My parents were going to sit up front, naturally. My two youngest sisters, 2 and 1, Esther was 2, Rebecca was 1. They were going to sit in the back seat in their car seats. And then there was Elizabeth and I. Where were we going to sit? So my dad had to outfit this truck so that it would be legal for us to sit in the back, in the bed of the truck. So we had a topper, at least. We had a topper, and he put a carpet down, and he put insulation in there so we wouldn't get cold. And he bolted down an old back seat from a different vehicle in the back of this truck, facing backwards. We were legal. We had seatbelts. Okay. So that's where my oldest sister was 7, and where I was 4, in the back seat. So this is me at 4. All right. So my parents were experts. I can point at making point A and point B, connecting all the dots so that we saw all the family and all the cool sights along the way. Because these road trips were really our family vacations. And so, naturally, starting in Coos Bay, Oregon, we're going up to Alaska. Where would you go first? The opposite direction, to Southern California. Because you have to see the grandparents before you go up to Alaska. They thought they would never see their kids or their grandkids ever again. We were going to the wilderness of Alaska. We were going to get eaten by bears. So we reassured the grandparents. We stopped off there. On our way back up to Oregon where we started, my dad sees a sign off on the side of the road. Puppies for sale. And he's thinking, I got the truck. I got the camper. I think I need a dog. So he turns to my mom and he tries to convince her, even though she says she's allergic to dogs, it's okay to get a dog, right? And it's okay to get a dog even though we're traveling thousands of miles over rough road. And it's okay to get a dog even if we don't know if housing in Kodiak will allow us to have a dog. So what do? We get a dog. Adorable little beagle puppy with a copper head. So naturally, we named him Copper. So my dad, he's got the truck, he's got the camper, he's got a dog. But there was one more thing that he needed for us to be Alaska ready. So as we're driving through Oregon, we stop off at an REI. Now, I'm sure you're thinking, like, what could we possibly need? Maybe, like, a tent or a camp stove, maybe a gun. There's bears, right? Furry critters. No. That's not what my dad needed. We walk into REI, and we walk out with a huge, bright red, old town canoe that could seat the entire family. So here we are. We have the big truck, we have the camper, and we have a bright red canoe. You couldn't miss us. We were Alaska ready and Alaska bound. We skip the States, we go up into Canada, we stop off at Fraser Lake Canyon. Beautiful. I highly recommend it. We took the tram across the river. I wish I could do it now as an adult. At the time, I was quickly realizing I had a fear of heights as we were going over the canyon. The next stop that I remember, one of my earliest memories, is stopping at Layered Hot Springs. If you haven't been, it's really awesome. Out in the middle of nowhere, you take this little boardwalk, you go into the pool, and lo and behold, the water is warm. So I'm in there, and I'm playing with my sisters, having a good time, and I see this man off to the side, and he's just kind of standing still. I turn to my dad, what's the matter with him? What's he doing? And my dad explained to me, oh, there's this challenge. If you look on the far side of the springs, the side that he told me not to go, because that's where the source of the heat of the springs was. If you take a stone and you slowly walk over there, letting your body acclimate to the heat, and then you put your stone on the far side of the springs, proving that you made it all the way over. I hear this, and at 4, I already had a strong sense of competitiveness. So I search for the nearest stone, grab this rock, and I'm like, I'm making it to the other side of that pool. So I slowly start making my way over there, pass this guy up. I got this. My parents are somehow oblivious to the fact that their 4-year-old daughter is electively scalding herself. As I am slowly making my way through this hot spring, it's getting hotter, it's getting hotter. I'm getting more and more uncomfortable. I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. But I still have this rock, and I still want it on the other side of the spring. So naturally, my childish self, I throw the rock. To this day, I still throw like a girl, and I missed. That was humiliating enough. The worst humiliation was walking past the guy who was still slowly making his way to the other side of the hot springs. I'll skip ahead since I'm late on time. The big event that I wanted to tell you, the event on this road trip that has changed me forever as a person, occurred between Anchorage and Homer. I'm not quite sure. So I'm sitting in the back seat with my sister, facing backwards. This would never happen nowadays. I get much carsick for that. We're coloring, just contented as could be, we're coloring. And all of a sudden, I see this tiny little spider. I'm like, huh. And I had this thought, like, well, I've got to squish it. It's in my space. I can't have a spider in my space. I'll squish it with my gray crayon. That way I don't notice the spider guts on the end of my crayon. This makes sense in my 4-year-old brain. So I squish the spider, and then there's another spider. And then there's another spider. All of a sudden, there are hundreds, it seems like thousands of spiders pouring from behind that bench seat all over me and my sister. I screamed bloody murder. And I'm doing this crazy dance. My dad, I'm sure, thought I was dying. I made a beeline out of the back of that truck as soon as he opened the door. And I'm puffing on the side of the road. Spiders! I guess a mama spider decided that the back of that bench seat was a perfect place to put her egg sack. And that was the perfect moment for them all to hatch, all over me and my oldest sister. So, needless to say, I refused to sit in the back of that cab ever again. So I was very contented to squeeze myself in between two car seats in the back seat of that truck. And that's where you could find me as the truck rolled off the ferry into Kodiak. And that's also how I got arachnophobia.
Isaac Simonelli, born and raised in Bloomington, Indiana. Isaac has spent most of his adult life living abroad. He came to Kodiak to take up a position at the Kodiak Daily Mirror after running an English language newspaper in Thailand and then had a brief stint at the Fairbanks Daily News Miner in the interior. He's been road tripping and traveling since he was old enough to drive. He returned to the U.S. to be closer to friends and family, who are apparently in the lower 48. Clearly, he missed the mark, but he's pretty stoked to be in Kodiak. Please welcome Isaac.
So a single die, which is the singular noun for a dice, the single die bounced across this green table, pool table in a bar in Thailand, Chiang Mai, Thailand. And if it was an odd number, I was going to sell my beloved motorcycle, Rossinetta. And I was going to get on a plane and fly to East Africa. If it was an even number, I was going to still sell the motorcycle. But instead, I was going to be taking a plane to Mongolia. Now, as usual, I really hadn't planned very far ahead. This was in the middle of December. Starting a six-month motorcycle ride in the dead of winter in Mongolia is a terrible idea. However, that was only going to happen if it was a 2, a 4, or a 6, right? So I had a chance. This was already 6 months into a one-year project that I self-funded called Dice Travels. The basic premise of Dice Travels was, for 365 days, I would roll dice to make most of my decisions. That means the dice were going to decide what I ate, where I slept, where I went, very much so where I went, and what I did. But I wasn't going to give all the power to the dice, right? I wanted to retain some semblance of free will. So I, like, if I wanted strawberry ice cream, like really wanted strawberry ice cream, I was going to have strawberry ice cream. It was this 40-60% range where you're like, I don't care what movie we watch tonight. I don't care what we make for dinner. That's where I was going to roll. And the dice led me to some very strange places. And the whole trip was supposed to be on this motorcycle, Rossinetta, right? But earlier on in the trip, the dice actually took me and Rossinetta to this hedonistic party town called Vang Vien in Laos that is, it's died down now some, but it was famous for its magic shakes, and I have, or had, never indulged in such kind of fungi at that point in my life. I was in my 30s, it just hadn't happened, and there the dice were like, hey, you should go to Vang Vien and check that out. And the one rule was once the die was cast, the Rubicon was crossed. I couldn't turn back. So there was no like, oh, that's a terrible choice. So they did that, and the other thing, the first really baffling thing the dice did to me were 1 month into the trip, I had already gone to Bangkok. I got all the paperwork so I could go to Myanmar, which was the first country outside of Thailand that the trip was destined. I got to the border and got bounced out of the border because I didn't have the right paperwork for Rossinetta. And I don't know if people here ride, but the relationship between a person and their motorcycle is kind of similar to like the relationship between a person and their boat, besides it's a lot cheaper. They get names, we love them, we care about them, we tinker on them. But I didn't have the right paperwork to get it in, so the choice was simple. I either had to ditch the motorcycle or go back to Bangkok and try to see if I had the money to get it sorted out. Self-funded, it became kind of like a 50-50 thing. So I rolled the die, and the die turned its back on Rossinetta. So that bike got left at a hotel on the border, and I huffed it across the border in like this drizzling rain, and I was unhappy about it. That night, I was in this, it was actually the same town that George Orwell wrote Killing an Elephant, and also where Kipling was very much inspired. I was in that town, this terrible little hotel, and I rolled a die for a weekly theme, just something to give me focus for a week. Like, what was I gonna do? And it was like, meditate. I had never meditated. I mean, never. I like the idea. I mean, I learned to burn incense when I was in high school. And I was like, sure, I can do this. So I was just going to, you know, I was like, easy. I'll cross my legs. I'll sit down. 10 minutes every morning, done and dusted. I've fulfilled the will of the diet, and then I'll go on with my day. That next morning when I was rushing to get my free breakfast at the hotel, on my plate, there was this pamphlet. There's a type of meditation called Vipassana. I think that's how you say it. Ooh, all right. Vipassana. And it basically, it's been held as a sacred form of meditation in Myanmar. I did not realize this. What I also did not realize was there was a monastery called Pak Ok Forest Monastery that was just outside of town. It was literally a city of thousands of monks who just hung out and meditated. The Dice not only liked the idea of me going to visit the monastery, the Dice liked the idea of me spending 10 days doing this type of meditation. Now, this meditation is one of those no-talking kind of things. Not like no talking while you're doing it, no talking the entire 10 days. So that was 10 days of waking up at 4 a.m., 10 days of no talking, 10 days of not eating after noon. So I arrived, the guy got me settled in. He was like, okay, here's where you sleep, here's the schedule. Do you know how to meditate? No. Okay, fine, sit down, make yourself comfortable. So I sat down cross-legged on the hard wooden floor. He's like, close your eyes, close my eyes. He's like, focus on your breath. You breathe in and out through your nostrils and notice right that spot. So I did that, and time passed really slowly. And he was like, silence? So I stepped there, and I was like, did he leave? Is he still here? Is this a test? And the attorney just played out in front of me. And eventually, he was like, open your eyes. Open my eyes. That was 5 minutes. I had 475 more minutes for a one full day of meditation. It was at that point I truly started to question what the Dice were doing. But nonetheless, 5 months later, when I was in Chiang Mai and that Dice was tumbling over the table, I was still addicted to it. It landed on a one. I ended up heading to East Africa. I was destined to meet Rafiki, a new little motorcycle, much better for the trails here than the miles I was doing from Nairobi to Zanzibar. I was destined to end up on the second tallest peak of East of Africa, Mount Kenya. And I was destined, when I arrived, desperately tired, wanting nothing more than just to be asleep, to instead be in a van going to the outskirts of a slum in Nairobi to an orphanage where at Couchsurfing said there was a free place to stay. And I was like, I'm paying everything, free place, done. To end up in this bed next to this sister Sarah, and she was wanting more than just to sleep. And I was just like, oh no. Thankfully, the Dice decided where I had to go, but they didn't decide I had to stay.
Our next storyteller, Danae McKinney, came to Alaska with her single mother in 1973, and that was her first big road trip. As a 9-year-old, she was very concerned that she might encounter quicksand and die, but soon found that moving to Alaska, she found more things to be more concerned about, like always having to carry a stick to make sure the ice was solid so that you wouldn't fall through and drown in the Arctic Ocean that Alaska floats on. Makes sense, right? Danae was a Rotary exchange student in Brazil in her senior year of high school. After graduation in Anchorage, she interned for Senator Ted Stevens in Washington, D.C. She moved to Kodiak with her husband, Rich, in 2003 with her two children, Richie and Katie, but are now almost empty nesters. They love it here and feel blessed to call this island their home and community. Ladies and gentlemen, Danae.
I got my reinforcements. It is just water, but it smells like chlorine. All right, so she told you that I first of all was afraid of quicksand. Then I was afraid of falling through the Arctic ice and dying here. So even though the theme of this is road tripping, my personal theme is be prepared and prioritize your actual fears. So, as a teenager, I was 19 at the time. My then boyfriend and I decided to take a road trip around Alaska. All the roads that we could drive on. I think we probably got to most of them. Excuse me. when we got to Chitna, we decided to take a little detour and head on up to McCarthy and the Kennecott Mines. Now, this is a long, long time ago. It's kind of a tourist attraction now, but back then it was literally the wild, wild west. So we decided to take this road. It was a dirt road. It took us 12 hours to drive from Chitna, I guess Chitina is really the word, all the way down to McCarthy. And all the way there, we saw signs that said gas, food, lodging. I was so excited. The car had, driven through a few potholes. Some of them were big enough to eat the car. Logs in the road. It literally took us 12 hours to drive from Chitna to McCarthy. When we got there, it was midnight, summer solstice, full moon, and a raging torrent of death river with giant boulders. We're camping, by the way, in the dirt, but there's no dirt, it's just all boulders. No gas, no food. There was an ATCO trailer with some dusty old cans in it and nobody there to sell it to you. I think it was $5 or $6 a gallon for gas if there had been somebody there. So I was furious. I literally was kicking the dirt. I was kicking the rocks. I was so mad. What did we see? We see this cart that you could ride across the river. Because I was wondering, where the heck is McCarthy? We drove all this way and there's nothing but dirt. So we were deciding if we were going to be bold enough to try and get our way across the river. Well, we didn't know that you could do it by hand by yourself, so we were debating what we were going to do. We were hundreds and hundreds of miles from anybody and any place. And from the middle of nowhere, this man appears. It's midnight. He has a box and a dog. No car, nothing. He's walking. He's wearing an old miner's outfit. He has the hat turned up. He has suspenders, flannel shirt. I didn't even hear him come. Not a twig, nothing. He was just there, and he said, "So I'll pull you across if you pull me across." I said, "Sure, why not?" So we get our little bodies in this cart. We pull him across first. He's on the other side now. And we get in the middle of this river, and it stops. Now, we didn't look at any directions. I don't even know if there were directions, but I suddenly realized, holy crap, we could be stuck here. What if he doesn't pull us the rest of the way across? It's midnight, summer solstice, in the middle of nowhere. Well, he did. He pulled us across. And then he says,
"So you want me to show you around town?"
I said, "Sure." It was only one road. It was dirt.
There's the old bar. There's the whorehouse.
And he named all these buildings that now don't have anything in them anymore. It's a ghost town. And I think, wow, that's just amazing that he knows the history of this place. And he walks around in a costume all the time. This is great. So I said to him, "Hey, you know, we're going to go on up to the mine tomorrow," because it was 5 miles beyond that. And you couldn't drive because there's no bridge. They did have some kind of a vehicle they drove over there in the winter over the frozen river, but that cost a lot of money and we didn't have any money. So we were going to hike up there. By the way, I was 150 pounds lighter back then, so I could walk up then. Anyway, I said to the guy, "Hey, maybe we'll see you tomorrow. We're going to go on up to the mine." He said, "No, I don't think you will be. My place on up for a piece up there." I said, "Oh, okay." And I looked at Rich and I literally looked back and he was gone. He disappeared. And I mean that. Rich was looking at him the whole time. He just disappeared. So, after that happened, I was kind of freaked out, but you know, the summer solstice, full moon in McCarthy. And we're walking back down the dirt road, and I remembered that my then boyfriend had brought a gun with him. He had a 44 Magnum, I think it was a 44 Magnum, in his coat. It was huge, big revolver. So I felt a little bit safe because I knew the guy, you know, couldn't get too close without getting shot. But he was gone. Anyway, I said to my then boyfriend, I said, "Wow, you know what I just remembered? Everybody in this town got killed. I mean, except for like 5 people. Not too long ago, a guy came through here and killed everybody in the town. This is really kind of creepy." And my then boyfriend looked at me, put his hand on the gun and pulled it out, and he said, "I'm home." It was at that moment that I realized, I don't know this person at all. I'm in the middle of nowhere. Where's the ghost? I need the ghost. And I ran as fast as I could run, probably for about a half a mile, till the then boyfriend caught up with me. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, we did see Kennecott the next day. Beautiful place if you've never been. They gave the miners an hour to get out of town. So everything is exactly like it was 100 and something years ago. About 100 years ago. And you can go there and see the old doctor's office and dinner plates on the table. And it's just exactly like it used to be. An amazing place to go. And now I realize that you just really need to prioritize what you're afraid of, because you just never know. Thank you.
We are introducing our Uncle Patrick, who was not signed up for tonight, but it's been one of those exciting, unpredictable galley table nights where some stories are like two stories long, and some stories are not about road tripping at all. That's about to happen. But one storyteller did not show up, and so Uncle Patrick agreed to get up here. And this is pretty much what happens to all the friends and family of Galley Table volunteers, is that we trick you into getting on the stage at some point or another. So happy birthday.
All right, it's my pleasure to introduce Patrick Conley, who grew up in Berkeley, California, and started running the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon in 1969 as a whitewater raft guide. He just drove from his home in Flagstaff, Arizona to Anchorage on the Alpine Highway, which has been a lifelong dream for him. He arrived in Kodiak yesterday to celebrate his 73rd birthday. And we're so glad he's here on our beautiful island with his kid sister and most of her family. He is on a road trip, obviously, and will tell a story from his misspent youth. Please welcome Patrick Conley.
Well, on this trip, I stopped in Vancouver to visit Reuben and Rosalie Lone, who just moved down there from Haines, and Sarah and Peter just got back from a 6-week trip or so. They went down to Phoenix to buy a car with all their kids. They came up to Flagstaff on their first night out with a new vehicle and whatnot, and then they took off, and I took off, and I beat them here by a day. So when I was in Vancouver, there's a young 10-year-old boy that's a grandson of my sister, Kate Lohan, and kind of for his benefit, I told a little story for him about, I think I might have been in 8th grade. My parents were pretty strict, and they wouldn't let me go to a movie. All the pretty girls in 8th grade got to go to movies on Friday or Saturday night. I had to go to the Saturday matinee. So that's what you get from a strict family. So I went to a matinee one Saturday, and I was walking home, and I got down, I was on San Pablo Avenue, Albany, California, right next to Berkeley, and this guy comes out of a black and white liquor store, and I'm waiting to cross San Pablo Avenue, which is 4 lanes, big street for Albany, main street, and he comes over, and he gets me like in a headlock, and I can smell the booze. He's drunk, and he's got a brown paper sack, and he starts telling me about he'd just been to a funeral, and how bad he felt with his friend and whatnot, and I'm 12 years old, 8th grade? And this guy's got me, you know, and I'm just trying to get home. So I've gotten mad right off the bat, but, we had to wait for the traffic, and he's blathering on. And we get across San Pablo, and his car was parked right there, and the Mallard Club, a bar, was right over here on the corner. And he said, "Well, I've got to go over and have a drink. I feel so bad." And he put that paper sack in his car. By that time, I was ready to kill this guy. If I'd been his size, he wouldn't have done it if I'd been his size. He's just picking on a little kid. So the only way I could think to get even with this guy was he hit it off for the Mallard Club. I opened his car door, grabbed that brown paper sack, and took off running for home. You know, and I got home, and I got down in the basement, and I opened it up. And my parents, once in a while, they'd have a glass of wine. They never had cocktails. In the bag, there was a big bottle of 7-Up and a pint of Jim Beam whiskey. And I had no idea that you put those things together. So My sister Kate, she really likes 7 Up. So I gave her the 7 Up. And I hid the pint of whiskey until next Saturday matinee. And I went to the matinee, and I got that whiskey, and it was bad tasting. And I'm drinking that, and that happened to be the weekend where the Jerry DuPont tap dancing studio, the little girls that get up and they got to get on the stage and show people how they could tap dance and whatnot. And the first 6 girls that were going to put on a show, they get up there, and I'm seeing 12. I'd never done this before. I'd never had a drop of any kind of liquor. And so I'm just drunk as a skunk because I drank the whole pint. And I'm not feeling too good, right? So I'm starting to get sick, and I go in the movie theater restroom, and I'm in there just getting sick. I don't know what's happening to me. I'm dizzy and wobbly. And somebody went and told the manager, and he comes in the bathroom, and he smells the liquor on me, and he throws me out of the theater. So I had to get down about 4 blocks. I'm feeling really bad, and I decided I'd go to the Albany bowling alley and get sick in there for a little while before I went home. And I'm feeling better. I've lightened my load, and I go out a side door, and I've got 2 blocks, 1 block over up the hill, and half a block, and I'm home. So I'm really close to home. So I get out there, and I'm just leaving the bowling alley, walking down the street, and a police car comes around the corner. And the policeman sees me, you know, weaving down the sidewalk. And he pulls over, and I, before he put me in the police car, I took my cigarettes and threw them in the gutter. And that policeman, he puts me in the car, closes the door, picks up my cigarettes, gets in the police car, takes me down to the police station. And we're in there, and he's telling me he's going to call my dad. And I'm crying at this point. Don't call my father. No, it'll kill him. It'll absolutely kill him. No, please don't. And he's kind of looking past me, and he says, oh, I don't think it'll kill him. I turn around, and my father's standing there. You know, and I'm one of 7 kids. I'm the youngest boy in the family of 4 older brothers. And anyway, I don't think it'll kill him. So I turn around, there's my dad, and I'm just totally drunk. And so my dad says, come on, Patrick, we're going home. And the police officer says, oh, Pat, here's your smokes. And my dad, he's a wonderful man. He took me home. He put me right to bed. And the next day, I caught hell for those cigarettes.
Our final speaker tonight is Carly Johnson. Carly Johnson is a national speaker, educator, and storyteller. Born in a cornfield in Iowa, not actually, raised in a small farm town in Illinois, then moved across the state to Windy City, Chicago, where she lives now. Carly, her family, including her adorable 1-year-old son, hubby, mom, and her production team, are visiting Kodiak this week to partner with Sunyak Tribe to educate the community on sexual violence and dating abuse. Known nationally for her TEDx talk, I Poop My Pants, Carly's mission is to speak out against violence using humor, storytelling, and education. College mascot, movie extra, master of Halloween costumes, and probably the world's best party starter, Carly loves connecting with fellow survivors, advocates, nerds, and squirrel lovers. Connect after the show or find her online at Miss Carly Johnson or www.carlyjohnson.com. Please welcome Carly.
First off, let me say, y'all are awesome. And we love Kodiak, and we have not seen bears yet, but we will. We're going to try. Anyways, so it was my very first road trip. Now, as a kid, I'm sure a lot of you might feel this way. Anything in a car that was over an hour felt like a road trip. But for me, it was my official first cross-country road trip. And the best part about it was that I actually got to take it with friends instead of my annoying brothers and my parents. So I was a freshman in high school. And our choir was going on this big trip to New York City. So, like she said, I grew up in a really, really small farm town on the border of Iowa and Illinois. Like, really, really small. And so we were so excited to go to New York City, and we were going to go to the Statue of Liberty and see Times Square and walk through Central Park. And Unfortunately, this was 2 years after 9/11, so we couldn't do a lot of things, but nevertheless, the thing we were most excited about was seeing famous people, right? Like, we were going to see everyone. It's New York City, of course. So we're about 15 hours into the drive, and we're in New Jersey, right? So we're, like, stuck in traffic, and we're so close. Like, we're getting bored and tired, and just we're done with the trip. And I remember having my portable, like, CD player, and I was listening to Avril Lavigne. Anyone? Right? Yeah? So I'm listening to, like, Skater Boy, and I'm, like, jamming. And all of a sudden, someone right behind me, because I was, like, in the back of the bus, and someone screams, "Oh my God, it's Bruce Willis." So we all like get up and we look over at the window and it's just some bald guy, right? Not at all. And so I was like so disappointed, but whatever. And we were young and stupid. And again, we were bored and restless. So we start waving to this guy and he starts waving back and he's looking at us. And my friend Ashton behind me starts like writing messages in her little notebook and she's holding it up. And we get bored, most of us, so I sit back down and I'm, you know, listening to Skater Boy rocking, and then all of a sudden I hear someone scream, "Oh my God, it's his dick." And so of course we're like, "What?" So we look out the window and this man is masturbating in front of us. So we start screaming, "Oh my God, it's his dick, it's his dick, it's his dick." And the front of the bus is screaming at us, "Shut up, shut up, shut up." And we're freaking out and they're yelling at us and we're yelling and we're just, everything is like chaos and we're trying to write down his license plate and he speeds away. And so we're sitting there, and we're horrified, and we're disgusted, and our trip is just ruined. And it hasn't even started yet, right? So we get into New York City, and I'm at the Statue of Liberty, and I see his pecker. And I'm at Times Square, and I'm like, there's this guy's schlong. And I just couldn't get it out of my head. And we kept laughing about it, and we kept, like, making fun of it. Like, it's, oh, yeah, it's so fun, it's so funny. But it wasn't funny. Like, I was horrified. I was humiliated. And I didn't understand why I felt so, like, violated. And I felt so dirty, and I was trying so hard to forget about it. And I couldn't forget, because it was so hard. And no pun intended, sorry. right? Anyways. So, but the thing about it was, we kept trying to make a joke about it. Kept trying to laugh about it. But if someone would have told me, I think, what I know now, you know, if they would have told me 16 years ago that, you know, Carly, what you experienced, that was sexual violence. Even though he didn't touch me, we were so far away from each other, that feeling of being violated and feeling terrible and you know, it was validated. Because when we think of sexual violence and sexual assault, we think of these terrible, awful, you know, some scary man behind a bush, right, attacking a woman. But this tiny little thing that had happened to us, this feeling of feeling horrible and awful, I felt more validated because if someone would have told me, "Carly, you know, this isn't no big deal. He didn't touch you. He didn't do anything like that." Would that have helped me? No, of course not. And I remember leaving New York. And no, we didn't meet any famous people. I never met Bruce Willis. But I remember leaving thinking, I am never, ever, ever, ever going back to New Jersey or New York ever again. I know, right? It was sad, but guess what? 2 years ago, I went back to New York. This time, I did not see a Bruce Willis masturbating, you know, lookalike. But what I did get to do was speak out against sexual violence. And I met some incredible, amazing people. And that is what I'm here to do now. And so I want to thank you, the community of Kodiak, for allowing us to come into your community to speak out, these amazing organizations that are here, that who are already doing great work. And so, like I said, connect with me afterwards. If anyone wants to be famous, wants to be interviewed, right? No? Anyone? Wants to share more stories? Let me know. But again, and when I went back to New York, it was a great experience. To this day, when I still see Bruce Willis, I still get a little, you know, gross feeling inside. So that's my story. Thank you.
Galley Table Storytelling is made possible through a partnership with the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Broadcasting Corporation. Visit us online at galleytables.com to find the date and location of the next live storytelling event. You can also browse our archives and listen to past stories or sign up to be a storyteller. Galley Tables, sharing stories and sharing life.